Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling some pretty advanced material science. We're looking at nanostructured bainite.
Yes, it's a fascinating material. Really pushes the boundaries of steel strength. We're talking about, you know, one of the hardest steels ever made in bulk.
In bulk, yeah. And the numbers are impressive, right? Up to 690 HV.
That's right. 690 hardness Vickers, which is, well, exceptionally hard for a structural material.
And that hardness doesn't just happen. It comes down to the microstructure, the internal architecture. Extremely fine.
Exactly. The key is getting these incredibly thin plates of what's called bainitic ferrite. We're talking 20 to 40 nanometers thick, just incredibly small.
Nanometers. So yeah, truly nanostructured. And achieving that, as I understand it, means transforming the steel at very low temperatures.
That's the trick. You need to cool it and hold it around, say, 200 degrees Celsius. That low temperature is what limits the growth, keeping things fine.
Okay, so that's the ideal. But there's a catch, isn't there? Pretty big one.
There is. Traditionally, getting the transformation to happen that low requires a lot of carbon in the steel, often around 1 weight percent.
And 1% carbon, well, that rings alarm bells for anyone thinking about welding.
Absolutely. High carbon means big problems in the heat-affected zone during welding. You get this untempered martensite forming.
Which is incredibly brittle.
Exactly. It just shatters. So it completely undermines the joint, the structural integrity. For most applications, especially things that need welding, you really want carbon below 0.2 weight percent.
So that's the conflict. You need high carbon for the ideal nanostructure, but low carbon for weldability.
Precisely. And that leads us to the mission in the research we're looking at today. Can we design a low-carbon nanostructured bainite?
Right. The idea being use something else instead of carbon to push that transformation temperature down, like substitutional solutes, nickel, manganese.
That was the hypothesis. Use these other elements dissolved in the iron to suppress the transformation temperature, get down to that 200 degree C range, but without the high carbon penalty.
Okay, so let's dive into the source material and see if they pulled it off. Did this substitution work?
Well, it all comes down to the thermodynamics, specifically the relationship between two critical temperatures.
Okay.
The bainite start temperature, BS, and the martensite start temperature, MS.
Right. The temperatures where those transformations, those phase changes begin to happen.
Exactly. And the crucial thing for getting this low temperature bainite is that you need the bainite to start forming before the martensite does. So BS needs to be significantly higher than MS.
You need a gap between them. A safe operating window.
You do. If MS is too close to BS or even higher, you risk forming that brittle martensite instead, or maybe a messy mix.
So why does carbon work so well at keeping that gap nice and wide?
It's about how carbon behaves during the transformation. Carbon atoms are small, they can move, they diffuse. When bainite starts to form, the carbon actually partitions.
Partitions, meaning it moves out of the newly forming bainite.
Yes, it diffuses out of the ferrite plates and into the remaining austenite. This partitioning effectively lowers the energy barrier for bainite formation. It helps it get started at a higher temperature.
Ah, so it gives bainite a kind of advantage, a head start over martensite.
That's a good way to think about it. Martensite, on the other hand, is diffusionless. The carbon atoms are just trapped wherever they happen to be when the transformation occurs.
No partitioning there.
None. So because carbon actively helps bainite form but doesn't help martensite form in the same way, it naturally creates and maintains that vital temperature gap between BS and MS.
Okay, that makes sense. Carbon's mobility is key. Now, what about the proposed replacements? Nickel, manganese, the substitutional solutes?
Well, that's where the problem lies, according to the source. These atoms are much larger than carbon. They move much, much more slowly in the steel lattice.
But no diffusion, no partitioning.
Essentially, no. They don't partition during bainite formation, and they don't partition during martensite formation either. They're just too sluggish.
So if they don't partition, how are they supposed to lower the transformation temperatures at all?
They lower the temperatures by affecting the overall thermodynamics, the driving force for the transformation. But crucially, they affect both bainite and martensite pretty much identically.
Ah. Okay. So if adding nickel lowers the temperature where bainite wants to start by, say, 50 degrees?
It also lowers the temperature where martensite wants to start by roughly that same 50 degrees. They push both temperatures down together.
So instead of widening the gap like carbon does, they just shift the whole thing down the thermometer, keeping the gap roughly the same or even shrinking it relatively.
Exactly. They're far less effective at maintaining that critical BS-MS separation. And the theoretical calculations bore this out early on.
What did the theory predict?
It was, well, pretty discouraging. The model showed that as you increase the concentration of these substitutional solutes, that BSMS temperature difference shrinks rapidly.
To the point where?
To the point where, in theory, if you add too much solute, the gap could disappear entirely. BS could become equal to or even lower than MS.
Which would make forming low-temperature bainite impossible. You'd just get martensite.
Right, or at least make it incredibly difficult. So this theoretical warning really set the stage for the experiment. They were trying something that thermodynamics suggested might be, well, problematic.
A real uphill battle then. Let's see what happened when they actually tried it in the lab. What alloys did they test?
They worked with an iron manganese nickel carbon system. They kept the carbon low around that target 0.2 weight percent and then made a series of alloys with increasing nickel content.
Alloys 4Ni, 5Ni, 6N, I see in the notes.
That's right, with alloy 6Ni being the most extreme case, pushing nickel up to nearly 7 weight percent, 6.74 to be precise.
Okay, a significant amount of nickel. And the goal was to use this nickel to push BS and MS down.
Yes, push them down into that desired low temperature range around 200, 300 degrees C while keeping the carbon low.
Did they succeed in lowering the temperatures?
They did lower the temperatures, yes. But, just as the theory predicted, the gap between BS and MS got smaller and smaller as they added more nickel.
How small did it get? What were the numbers for that high nickel alloy 6Ni?
For alloy 6Ni, the measured martensite start temperature, MS, was around 272 degrees C, and the bainite start, BS, was estimated to be only about 300 degrees C.
Wow, okay, so only a 30 degree difference between the start temperatures. That's cutting it really fine.
Extremely fine. A 30 degrees C window is very narrow thermodynamically, and it flagged up immediate problems with kinetics, the speed of the transformation.
Right, because transforming steel involves atoms moving around, and at these lower temperatures, everything just slows down, doesn't it?
Drastically, especially when you're asking it to perform this complex bainite transformation within such a tiny temperature window just above the point where martensite could form. The driving force is low, mobility is low.
So the transformation must have been incredibly slow.
Unbelievably slow. The source material highlights this quite dramatically. To actually get the bainite transformation to go to completion in some of these low carbon, high nickel alloys, well, it took weeks.
Weeks.
Yes. For alloy 6Ni specifically, to achieve the final microstructure, they needed a heat treatment lasting 12 weeks, held at 280 degrees C.
12
weeks.
3 months. Just for one sample's heat treatment.
3 months, continuous heat treatment.
Okay, that's just not practical for any kind of industrial process. Mm-hmm. If you're aiming for a steel that can be used in large structures, cars, whatever, you can't have a three-month heat treatment.
Absolutely not. It kills the commercial viability right there. The cost, the time, the furnace capacity, it's a non-starter.
It really makes you question the whole approach then.
It does. And the researchers themselves noted that this extreme slowness suggests we might need to rethink how we even define or measure the bainite start temperature in these kinds of sluggish systems. If it takes 3 months to finish, when did it really start?
That's a fair point. So the kinetics were a huge problem, maybe even a fatal flaw in terms of practicality. But was that the only issue? Did the structure that eventually formed after 12 weeks actually look good?
Ah, well, that leads us to the other critical failure. It wasn't just slow. The final structure wasn't what they wanted either. This is the problem of coalescence.
Coalescence. What did the structure look like?
Under a regular optical microscope, the bainite in these low-carbon, slow-transformed alloys looked blocky.
Blocky. That doesn't sound like thin, long, slender plates.
Not at all. It's the opposite of the desired nanostructure. The ideal nanobainite has those distinct, ultra-fine, separated plates. Blocky implies coarseness.
So what was happening at the nanoscale? Did they look with more powerful microscopes?
They did. Using transmission electron microscopy, TEM, they saw exactly what was going on. There was a coalescence process.
Meaning the plates were merging.
Yes. It seems the fine platelets, maybe initially forming at that target 20 nanometer thickness, were actually merging together edge to edge to form much thicker, coarser blocks. The source even points out specific regions in the micrograph showing this happening.
So they lost the nano aspect during the transformation itself. Why? Why would they merge? What's different in these low-carbon alloys?
It comes back to the carbon, or rather, the lack of it. Remember how in high-carbon bainite, the carbon partitions into the remaining austenite?
Yeah, it moves into the parent phase.
Well, that carbon-enriched austenite tends to form stable, thin films between the growing bainite plates.
Acting like spacers.
Exactly, like little walls keeping the plates separate. But in these low-carbon alloys, there isn't enough carbon partitioning to stabilize those intervening austenite films properly.
Ah, so without the spacers.
Without the spacers, if two adjacent bainite plates happen to nucleate with the same crystallographic orientation, there's nothing to stop them from just growing into each other and merging into one larger, coarser block.
Okay, that makes mechanical sense. But doesn't merging plates like that, creating a coarser structure, require extra energy? Usually, low-temperature transformations are energy-starved.
That's the really crucial insight here, linking the kinetics back to the final morphology. Remember how we said the transformation was really sluggish, nucleation limited? The measured BS temperature was quite low.
Right, only 30 degrees above MS for alloy 6Ni.
But that measured BS was actually well below another theoretical temperature called T9.
What's that signify?
Think of T9 as roughly the highest temperature where you could theoretically get 90% of the possible bainite to form if kinetics were an issue. It represents the maximum thermodynamic potential.
Okay, so the actual start temperature BS was way below this theoretical maximum potential temperature T9 unitown.
Yes, and that large difference between T-dyes and the actual BS meant that once nucleation finally happened, after maybe weeks, there was a huge amount of excess thermodynamic driving force available.
Like pent-up energy released once a reaction finally got going.
Precisely. The difficult start meant lots of stored potential. And that excess free energy, that surplus driving force, was more than enough to overcome the strain energy costs associated with forming the coarser, blockier, coalesced plates.
So the coalescence wasn't just a random defect. It was actually thermodynamically favored because of the specific conditions created by using substitutional solids.
That's what the analysis suggests. The system used the available excess energy to form a coarser, higher strain, but ultimately accessible structure. It's a really unfortunate outcome.
It's like a cruel twist. The very conditions they created to suppress the temperature ended up providing the energy to ruin the nanoscale structure.
Exactly. The attempt to solve the weldability problem by lowering carbon and using solutes led directly to conditions that promoted this unwanted coarsening. It fundamentally undermines the whole point of making nanostructured bainite, which is the strength you get from that extreme fineness.
So, wrapping up the core findings then. Using substitutional solids like nickel did lower the transformation temperature, which was the initial goal.
Yes, but it came with huge downsides. It drastically shrank the crucial BS-MS gap,
leading to incredibly slow, industrially impractical transformation, times weeks long.
And critically, even when the transformation finished, the low-carbon environment and the excess driving force led to platelet coalescence, destroying the desired nanostructure,
resulting in a blocky, coarser structure instead.
Right. So based on this work, the conclusion in the source is pretty clear. The prospects for making a truly low-carbon, weldable, nanostructured bainite using this substitutional solute strategy look, well, not very promising.
Seems like a dead end, at least via this route. It's a fascinating story of battling thermodynamics and kinetics.
It really is a classic material science challenge.
Okay, before we wrap up, let's leave our listeners with that final provocative thought you mentioned earlier, something that connects this structural failure to another critical property.
Right. So beyond just strength and weldability, another key advantage of traditional high-carbon nanobainite is its resistance to hydrogen. Hydrogen atoms diffusing into steel can cause catastrophic embrittlement.
A big issue for things like pipelines, pressure vessels.
Definitely. And the source notes that nanobainite's excellent hydrogen resistance seems linked to those thin films of retained austenite. We talked about the spacers. Apparently, the resistance drops sharply if the volume fraction of this retained austenite falls below about 10%.
Okay, so those austenite films aren't just spacers. They're functional barriers against hydrogen, too.
It seems that way. So here's the thought. We just saw that the low-carbon approach failed precisely because it couldn't effectively stabilize these intervening austenite films, leading to coalescence.
Right. The very structures that seem important for hydrogen resistance were lost or compromised.
Exactly. So the question is, even if they could somehow overcome the kinetic and coalescence issues to make a low-carbon version, how would this inherently different microstructure, likely with less stable or less well-distributed austenite, affect the steel's fundamental resistance to hydrogen-induced failure?
Could the attempt to gain weldability inadvertently create a material that's much more susceptible to hydrogen embrittlement over its service life?
It's a definite possibility. You might solve one problem only to create another, potentially more insidious one. It highlights how interconnected all these properties are: strength, toughness, weldability, environmental resistance.
A really complex balancing act. Improving one thing can easily compromise another.
That's the perpetual challenge in materials design.
Indeed. A fascinating place to leave it. Well, that's all we have time for on this deep dive. Thanks for joining us as we explored the difficult journey towards a weldable super steel.